everybody worked up for the operation, and here we are probably on theatre day. So how can we improve things here? I've heard you talk before, and some really quite dramatic things that you've said about anaesthetics. So anyway, yeah. Tell us what we can do on the day.
So the something that I only realised when I was reading into sustainable healthcare is the impact of anaesthetics on the environment. The actual anaesthetic gas is much more potent than CO2 in terms of global warming. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the fact that the operating theatre itself has a massive carbon footprint. So some of the things that we can do is to reduce the amount of those anaesthetic gases that are needed. I don't think we can directly tell the anaesthetist what anaesthetic to give, but making sure that they consider sustainability when they're choosing their anaesthetic. So it's important to consider whenever possible to use local anaesthetic, because mm-hmm. that will have make a massive improvement in the amount of climate gases that are produced, and or regional anaesthetic. So if you can have the operation done under spinal or under a block, again, that's better. So we could do that for perianal conditions, even for inguinal hernias, we could be doing more under local anaesthetic. Another thing to think of, nitrous. So the Entonox gas that we use, it is slightly less common these days, but that is also a very potent climate gas, much worse than CO2. So we can try and avoid using that for analgesia. So there is a replacement that's available. Most A&Es will have those. It's called Penthrox. So if you were wanting to do a procedure that on the ward, and you're thinking of using Entonox, the alternative, the more sustainable alternative, is called Penthrox, that you need to look for.
Okay, we'll look out, because we get through quite a lot of Entonox in our endoscopy department as a substitute for intravenous sedation. So it might be better to give people intravenous sedation from our carbon footprints use Penthrox. Yeah. Are there savings to be made in what we use actually in theatre?
Yes. So. So as long as you're considering all the other things that I've mentioned first, there are then still big changes that you can make within the operating theatre. I've mentioned this, the hierarchy: reduce, reuse, recycle. So recycling is always, it's better than throwing it away, but it's always sort of a much lower down the hierarchy. So reusing is very valuable. So considering everything within the operation that's possible to reuse. And there are some things that, you know, I'm a surgeon, and I recognise that some things that are fully reusable just aren't quite as good as when you use them for the first time. But you can have hybrid versions. So where the majority of the instrument is reused and can be re-sterilized, but a small part is disposable. So there are some laparoscopic ports that have been evaluated fully recently by the Royal College of Surgeons sustainability fellow, and she looked at the carbon footprint of using these hybrid ports and hybrid scissors and a hybrid clip applicator in a laparoscopic cholecystectomy compared to the single use version, and looking at it's called the life cycle assessment. So looking at its production right from the start, and then also all the energy that's going into the re-sterilizing, as well as the disposal of the single use products. And she demonstrated that not only were there the reusable ones cheaper, so important for the NHS, but they had a much, much smaller carbon footprint. And if you multiply that across the number of lap colis that we do in the NHS, that makes a big difference to the carbon footprint.
So that's really interesting, because one of the reasons I think, you know, years ago we moved from reusable to disposable was that the costs of re-sterilisation were more than the cost of the reusable instrument. And then, of course, the other thing was that we all remember doing lap colis with that dreadful leaky valve.
So these, the valve itself is disposable, but the rest of the instrument is reusable.
You can still do a good operation without swearing.
Yes, exactly.
But be sustainable, because these hybrid things are the way forward. So we're going to have to, you know, dispose of something, I suppose, aren't we, in the end?
Yeah.
What can we do there in theatre? Because I've heard you talk about, you know, something as mundane as plastic bags.
Absolutely. So reduce, reuse, recycle. So recycle still is part of the sustainability hierarchy. And so in the operating theatre, some theatres have a policy that everything should be put into a clinical waste bag. And actually that is not true. And the thing with the clinical waste bags is they get sent to high temperature incineration, which is very carbon intense. So if you can reduce the amount of waste that's going to the clinic in the clinical waste bags, you will reduce the carbon footprint and the cost of the operating theatre. So that you can use some of the things from the theatre, for example, the outer wrappers, especially the paper bit of the wrapper, can go to recycling if it hasn't touched the patient or been contaminated with any clinical substances. That can still go to recycling. And then there's also a lot of stuff from the theatre that can go to normal waste, even in itself, which is lower energy to dispose of. And so that only as little as possible within your operating theatre to get sent to clinical waste, and that will help reduce waste in the operating theatre as well.
Okay, so how many bins do you have in your theatre?
That's one of the difficult things, because you end up with lots of different bins. So if you have to think a little bit strategically of where they're placed. But so in the scrub up area, you don't need any clinical waste, because where you're cleaning yourself, that is all normal stuff. So you need to have a normal waste bag and a recycling bag, because the paper from the gloves goes in the recycling, but the plastic bit goes in the normal waste. And then next to the patient, you need to have a clinical waste. And so you need to have three in a row, really, so that they can have all of them. And then you need a separate one for when you're reusing your gowns, because, again, having reusable gowns and reusable drapes will certainly make a reduction.
So you need everybody on board for this, don't you? Because, you know, you're scrubbed, and you know, it must break your heart to see somebody putting something in a wrong bin. I'm not joking. It sounds slightly facetious when I say that. I'm absolutely not joking at all. It's desperately important. But how do you get everybody in theatre on board with this, and how do you raise awareness and make sure people do the right thing?
So I try to use the team brief at the beginning of the day, is talking about, especially it's worked best when their anaesthetist is also on board. And there are some, there's a lot within the anaesthetic spheres, because of this understanding of their gases, there are many people are involved with the among the anaesthetists. So having myself and the anaesthetist at the morning team brief kind of really emphasised the importance for all of this, really helps to get all of the theatre team on board to talk about what we need to be doing through the day, of, you know, making sure we minimise the amount that's being used, but also that it's then disposed in the right way at the end of the day. And sort of almost having a competition of how few clinical waste bags we can have throughout the theatre. For example, the non-clinical waste bags don't need to be changed between each case, so they can leave them and see if we can get one for the whole day, like a competition.
Oh, okay. Do you have a leaderboard between theatres?
Not yet, but perhaps that's the next step.
Yeah. So I mean, so that comes on sort of incentives, doesn't it? I mean, you know, what's in it for everybody? And obviously, the trust overall has a target to meet set by the NHS plan, as you said right at the start of this. But it's everybody's problem, as you said. So, you know, how do we motivate people in general? You know, we've got a post-COVID, reasonably, you know, often quite tired, sometimes demoralised workforce who might not be, this might not be at the top of their priorities. So how do we get people involved? How do we motivate people?
Behaviour change is the most difficult part of this movement, and that's something that's been struggled with through the whole process since it was recognised. But I think people are becoming a lot more aware now, and just talking about it more, and making sure that everyone knows about these issues, and creating podcasts like this so that everyone is aware. I think that's the most important thing, to get the word out.
Yeah, those statistics, you know, the NHS is 5% of the UK's carbon footprint, and aesthetic gases are 10% of that, that, you know, one in 20 vehicles on the road are related to the NHS. I mean, they're really powerful statistics, aren't they?
But on the other hand, a equally powerful statistic was a recent survey of NHS workers of whether they think that it's an important issue and they should be making changes at work. 98% of them said that they should be making a difference, you know, that it's everyone's responsibility. So it's brilliant that actually healthcare workers do recognise that this is a problem, and I think they just want to know what they can do.
Yeah, I mean, there is a big gap, isn't there, between should and do.
Yes.
So I suppose our job, you know, everybody's job is to make sure that the do is as easy as possible. There aren't any barriers in that thing from intention to action.
Yeah.
Where would we find some resources or information to help us with this?
A Centre for Sustainable Healthcare that has a lot of information on, and that's got the principles of sustainable healthcare and lots of other ideas of how you can improve your healthcare setting.
Is there a tool for adding up your climate impact, your carbon footprint within the workspace?
Yes, except it does seem very slightly complicated to use, because it does involve a lot of, you know, how many clinic appointments do the patient have, but there is on the Centre for Sustainable Healthcare website, they do try and show you how to do it. It isn't very easy to calculate.
Okay, so they probably need to up their game with a ready reckoner, don't they?
Yeah.
So what other resources would you, so I'm enthused after hearing you talk today, Cleo. I really want to, you know, get out there and do those things I probably should have done 5 years ago or more. What other resources are available to help us make the case, to show us what to do to move this forward? Centre for Sustainable Healthcare website, that's a good place to go.
That's the first step.
Why do most staff drive to work?
I can give the most information about my trust, which I guess is in London, and so that is different from yours. But we've got quite a big car park at St George's, and I have been involved in trying to reduce the number of people driving. And I've seen recently the statistics of who drives, and I think it's the vast majority, like 95% of the permits are towards medical doctors, healthcare staff, and only 5% are nurses, and a tiny proportions are other specialties. So I suspect outside of London, there are more across the board, but I still think doctors are in the majority. People think it's a status symbol to be able to drive. And I think as doctors, we need to really take responsibility and see driving to work for what it is. It's almost as I think it's even more harmful than smoking. Historically, doctors were kind of almost one of the worst for smoking. And we need to lead on the change to more sustainable travel and more healthy forms of travel. Oh, and the other reason I think that doctors drive, I think, is related to our training structure. So the fact that, you know, from medical school, we may have been students not being able to have a car and didn't drive everywhere. But through our training, because of the fact that we're sent all the way around the country, it is impossible to have a life as a trainee without being able to live in one place and driving to all the hospitals. It embeds driving to work into our lifestyle. And I think if we could change that, I don't think there's very good evidence for a big benefit for moving hospitals all the time. I think there is a part of it that is essential to be able to get doctors to some of the more remote hospitals. But I think if we reduce the number of hospitals we move in our training, we can, it's better quality of life for the trainees, but it also will be able to embed being able to live somewhere that you can within active travel distance of the hospital, and reduce the number of doctors that are driving. So that's my sort of wide answer to that question.
The other thing as well that you alluded to right at the start was obviously with COVID, we haven't gone anywhere. I haven't been to London for a meeting for over a year. I used to go about two or three times a week. So my personal carbon footprint was reduced dramatically. What do you think the impact of, you know, should we stay online and only have face-to-face meetings when absolutely necessary? And should we move teaching to online rather than people travel around the region to this? What do you think the overall potential benefits of moving to online engagement is?
Exactly. I think COVID has been really valuable at demonstrating to us how workable these models are. And I think, you know, I've had some really valuable teaching over the last year just online. And it's just so much easier. I can come home, see my family, then just pop upstairs, be involved with a webinar for a bit, and then still be finished in time to put them to bed. Whereas if I had to go to a meeting, I just wouldn't see them at all. But at the same time, like you say, it's reducing your carbon footprint. And but I do, you know, I do miss seeing you. So as in all the ASGBI community that I haven't been able to see in person. And so I think there's going to be a balance. You know, it's not going to be all one or all the other. But I think we need to focus on doing both.
Cleo Kennington, thank you very much indeed. That was wonderful. I'm going to go out there and do all those things.
Oh, brilliant. It's great to hear.